From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. If you've ever marveled at the artistry of Citizen Kane, or sneered at the 90s cult film Starship Troopers, or decided that Raging Bull is the greatest film of all time, then today's discussion is for you. We're exploring why films give us pleasure. Todd Berliner is a professor of film studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He was also the founding chairman of that department, and he's the author of Hollywood Incoherent, Narration in 70s Cinema. His newest book, Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema, was published this year by Oxford University Press. Today, we're going to explore the aesthetics of Hollywood with Professor Berliner, how styles have evolved, why some films bring us more pleasure than others, which seemingly follow similar formulas, and why some films fall flat or leave us cold. What makes the difference between a blockbuster and a bomb? It's a behind-the-scenes tour of Hollywood today. Todd Berliner, welcome to Coastline.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And we're inviting you to join us. Tell us about your favorite film of all time and why it's your favorite. Let's make our own greatest films of all time list today. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Todd Berliner, before I read your book, if someone said, "Why do films bring pleasure?" I would have said, "That's simple. It's an emotional catharsis, or it's an escape to fantasy, or it's passing the time." But this is much more layered. Tell us about why you dove into what you're calling the aesthetics of Hollywood films.
Well, I wanted to understand Hollywood movies as an art form. And it may seem obvious or maybe even strange to some people that we would think of Hollywood as an art form, because Hollywood movies, well, on the one hand, they're seen as mass entertainment, and a lot of people don't think of mass entertainment as an art form. And although people might recognize, and many people had written about Hollywood movie, individual Hollywood movies as works of art, say the works of Frank Capra or Alfred Hitchcock or Orson Welles, say, nobody had done a study of the art form itself, of Hollywood cinema as a way to give aesthetic pleasure to mass audiences. And I want to try to understand how Hollywood movies do that, because in the book, I argue, and I believe, that that's the primary reason people go to Hollywood movies, because they want to experience aesthetic pleasure. Go ahead.
Now, is there a difference between a blockbuster film that does really well at the box office, that appeals to mass audiences in terms of its artistry, and a film that maybe doesn't do so well at the box office, but that decades later film scholars are still talking about?
There is. And I would say people go to Hollywood movies not just for aesthetic pleasure. They go for other reasons as well, such as the reasons that you gave, maybe for fantasy or other reasons. And people see Hollywood movies for all sorts of reasons, because of advertising, etc. But when we talk about the movies that people love, and especially the movies that last a long time, they do tend to fall into a certain category. They tend to be more complicated because people like to watch them over and over. They tend to be somewhat novel, somewhat strange for Hollywood movies. And those and other features that we can talk about, I think, account for why some movies last longer than others. They withstand the test of time.
Well, let's try this out. We have a couple of clips here, audio clips that we can listen to. And one of these clips is from His Girl Friday. What year was this film made?
This is 1940.
1940.
Yeah, and this is Howard Hawks' screwball comedy, which is a comedy of sort of competition between the sexes. And the thing about screwball comedies is that the Well, the thing about any romantic comedy is that there has to be something that keeps the couple apart. That's what defines the comedy. And in Screwball, it's they hate each other. That's why they don't get together. They hate each other. And or that's the typical Screwball plot. So in this clip from His Girl Friday that you're going to show, we're going to be hearing three characters. We're going to one played by Cary Grant and another by Rosalind Russell. And they are the couple that hate each other but are going to you know, ultimately, you know, well, we don't want to give too much away. But we're going to hear a third actor who's Ralph Bellamy, and he is engaged to the Rosalind Russell character. And what in this clip I want people to note is how busy it is. It's just packed with information, both important information to understanding the plot. Hildy's a newspaper reporter, and her ex-husband, played by Cary Grant, is a newspaper editor.
The one she hates.
The one she hates. And you'll hear in this clip just the busyness of this movie, probably the talkiest movie ever made.
Okay, let's listen.
Hildy.
No, no, never mind the Chinese earthquake, for heaven's sake.
Hildy, I just want to ask you one question.
Bruce, how did you get out of jail?
Well, not through any help
of
yours.
Now, listen, buddy, you can't come in here.
I'm not talking to you. I had to wire Albany for $100 so I could get out on bail.
Look, I don't care if there's a million dead.
I don't know what they're going to think up there in Albany. They had to send the money to the police station.
Oh, for Pete's sake, Hildy, come on. We're waiting for that story.
We'll explain everything to them, Bruce.
Well, where's Mother? She said she was coming up here.
She left.
No, I can't hear you, Duffy.
Where'd she go?
Out someplace.
No, no, junk the Polish corridor.
Hildy, tell me where my mother was going.
One of the things that stands out in that clip is that they're not all talking to each other. What's happening there?
Yeah, there's actually, I should have mentioned this, there's actually a fourth character in that scene whom you don't hear because Cary Grant is on the phone talking to his city editor. And so he's talking to the city editor. Rosalind Russell is talking to Ralph Bellamy, but they're occasionally jutting in and talking to each other. And it's a very simply filmed scene. It's mostly just a long shot and then with occasional cut-ins. But you can tell the dialogue is messy. And the trick for the actors and the filmmakers and the writers is that you have to make the scene coherent to an audience, because if it's confusing, people are going to be alienated. It's mass art. It can't be too confusing. But on the other hand, they seem to pepper that conversation with all sorts of information that doesn't advance the plot. It just sort of makes it funnier and more interesting, like the Polish corridor and the Chinese earthquake and all sorts of other things that are going on in the scene.
And it's interesting, too, because if you read that scene on a piece of paper, if you look at it line by line, even though the guy on the phone isn't talking to the same people in the room, some of his lines sort of turn into barbs. Is that right?
At yes.
The people.
Right. So, you know, there's sometimes some confusion about who's talking to whom. You don't hear the Duffy who's on the other side of the phone, but you hear Walter talking to him and you kind of infer what Duffy must be saying to Walter. And I think this is a good illustration, this clip, of that area that Hollywood needs to target between boredom and confusion. And this one is a particularly confusing scene. It's less confusing if you're watching the movie in context. Much more confusing listening to it on the radio.
Yes.
But Hollywood has to target this area between boredom and confusion so that on the one hand, it doesn't alienate a mass audience by being too confusing. But on the other hand, if it's too simple, people are bored.
Can you give us an example of a film that maybe was too simple for a mass audience that falls into that same time period and same style that, you know, tried to be a screwball comedy and tried to start out this romantic story with the two, the male and the female, hating each other?
Well, screwballs tend to be edgier and more interesting and complicated than most comedies from the 40s. Screwball was a genre that lasted from roughly 1934 to about 1944. We still have some movies that today that we might call screwballs. So, but of course, romantic comedy is a notoriously simple genre, especially these days. Maybe not during that period when I mentioned. But a movie today like Leap Year, say, you know, a romantic comedy. Lots of people love it, but it's not necessarily going to withstand the test of time that His Girl Friday has.
We have an email from Kelly, and we're talking with film studies professor Todd Berliner of UNCW about the aesthetics of Hollywood film. And his newest book is called Hollywood Aesthetic: Pleasure in American Cinema. And Kelly, we're asking people to write in or call in with their favorite films, and we'll let Professor Berliner pick apart why this particular film might bring an audience pleasure. Put him on the spot a little bit. So Kelly writes, Princess Bride has been my favorite movie since about 1998 and is one of the only movies I've ever liked better than the book. Three Amigos and Raising Arizona are right behind it. Princess Bride is one of those films that often winds up on the big, you know, great comedies list or great films of all time list, or not.
Yeah, and it's an interesting movie. I haven't seen it in a number of years, but what I remember about it is it's kind of a mess, that movie. It's not as tight. I mean, I think it's a good illustration of the type of movie I'm talking about because it's not as tight as people tend to expect from a comedy or a romantic comedy. This is kind of a period piece comedy.
When you say tight, what do you mean by that?
Well, a tight movie is a logical one. Story logic is strictly obeyed. Everything makes sense. There's a kind of cause and effect relationship between every single element, nothing extraneous. And that's a neat movie. That's a compact movie. Princess Bride goes in all sorts of directions. It's got all kinds of anachronisms and side plots and strange characters. And I think people might think of that movie as a simple movie, but I don't think it is. It's certainly not conventional. And I think one of the reasons, was it Kelly?
Yes.
Likes the movie is it's strange. It's a little odd. And I think a lot of people find that movie strange and therefore interesting. It's certainly charming. It's certainly romantic. It's certainly fantastic. But it's also a little obscure. And it feels almost like a cult movie that way.
You talk about, you know, extraneous information or how much information in some films that are tight, it delivers only the information we need to follow that particular plot line. When we come back from this break, I want to ask you about when a film violates that idea and starts giving lots of seemingly extraneous information. You have a great line in your book about that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation with film studies professor Todd Berliner of UNCW about why Hollywood films give us pleasure. His newest book, Hollywood Aesthetic Pleasure in American Cinema. Tell us about your favorite film today or ask a question of our guest by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about the reasons behind the pleasure we get from a really good Hollywood movie. Guiding our exploration today is film studies professor Todd Berliner of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's also the author of Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. We want to hear from you about your favorite films, why you like them. Give us a call during this live Thursday show at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Todd Berliner, in a different section of your book that I think deals with ideology, you talk about why narratives come with this built-in gestalt or worldview and how extraneous information is not helpful or productive. On page 148, you write, in a Hollywood movie, a character's death scene is the wrong time for UPS to deliver a package. And I just find that hilarious. Strange. But that line, it just made me laugh out loud for a long time. And so then, of course, I imagine a scene in which the UPS guy does show up during a death scene. Can you talk about why that is such a good illustration of extraneous information and what that does to a plot line?
Well, that movie would be a comedy, obviously, and the one you're imagining, and or the one I imagined in the book. And it would be a comedy because comedy tends to be created through incongruity, something out of place, something strange, something that breaks our genre or our concept of what should happen in a scene like that. And so Hollywood movies tend to be unified, except in comedies. Hollywood movies tend to be unified in such a way that something like that would never happen. It could happen in real life, and we wouldn't think it's funny. It would be strange. It would be awkward, whatever. Or it would be a distraction. But in a movie, it wouldn't happen because in a Hollywood movie, things are sort of magically unified. So good characters tend to look handsome. Bad characters tend to look ugly. There's a movie from the 50s called Pickup on South Street that the villain is a communist. And he's not only ideologically obnoxious, he's repulsive looking. And the movie uses all sorts of stylistic means to make him repulsive. He sweats, he snarls, he has low-key lighting, etc. So Hollywood movies, and it's not just Hollywood movies, classical art forms generally lean toward unity. But they also, classical art forms tend to be malleable. And you can get elements in a Hollywood movie that are out of place, that seem wrong for the scene or wrong for the genre or where the music is wrong or the performance is wrong. A good example might be A Clockwork Orange, where you have classical music over a brutal fight scene, or you have the main character singing in the rain as he's raping a woman. And that type of incongruity, which borders on comic, can also be interesting and challenging for an audience.
We actually have an example of A Clockwork Orange. This is about the way the film uses music.
Yes, and in this clip that you're going to play, it's a fight scene. There's a gang brawl going on, and you'll hear how Stanley Kubrick scores the scene.
Okay, let's listen.
So, if Stanley Kubrick came to you and said, okay, I've got this fight scene and I've got a great idea for the music for the scene. It's going to be the overture to the opera by Rossini, The Thieving Magpie. You would say that's nuts. That's the wrong decision. It's right. Incongruous with the scene. But that type of incongruity or complexity, that makes that decision, that artistic decision, interesting.
You've talked a couple of times now in this conversation about how there has to be, for pleasure, for an audience to get pleasure from a film, there's got to be enough unity, and it's got to be simple enough that a mass audience can kind of follow what's happening without being too challenged. But there's a line there, because if it's too simple, an audience is going to get bored and check out. But then there's also there are more complicated works that require a lot more cognitive effort that stimulate other audiences. Can you talk about the difference between those kinds of films and give us examples of those?
Sure. So, when we think about the most routine Hollywood movie, like Leap Year or the Rocky sequels, or No Time for Sergeants.
How many Rockies were there, actually?
Seven, maybe. So eventually, those are routine movies. They're going to become boring eventually. You might enjoy them on contact because they're understandable, they're clear, their plots are simple, they're relatively unified. But they tend not to be movies that you return to over and over. Then there are the others, the more complicated end, like you mentioned Raging Bull in the opening, or Godfather 2, or The Big Sleep, or The Killing. These are movies that are more challenging, either narratively or stylistically or ideologically, or how they use genre. Double Indemnity would be another. Film noir in general would be a more complicated series of movies. These movies are still Hollywood movies. So they have to be understandable on contact. They can't require much training in the way that, say, opera requires some training before you start to enjoy it. But on the other hand, they are challenging in one way or another, ideologically, narratively, stylistically, or in their genre properties. And that measure of challenge is what makes us return to them again and again.
Now, if a film was challenging in all of those ways, narratively, ideologically, stylistically, does that put it on a level that's just too much and
Probably.
People say this isn't fun?
Yeah.
So it's got to kind of pick the way in which it's going to challenge a viewer.
If it's going to be a Hollywood movie.
Right.
Now, there are movies that are challenging in all those ways that are not Hollywood movies, meaning they're not designed for a mass audience. But if you want to appeal to mass audience, if you've got complexity in one area, you've got to go simple in another area. Because if an audience becomes too challenged, they just give up. They give up the search for understanding, a mass audience. Now, experts like film scholars and people who enjoy avant-garde movies, et cetera, they can handle more complexity in multiple areas. But if you're going to make a mass audience, if you're going to please a mass audience, you've got to simplify in some areas so that the audience is not going to become alienated. And that's the trick. And I would say, you know, people might say, well, that's the problem with Hollywood movies, and maybe the problem with mass art generally is that it's too simple. But I don't see that as a failing. That's just a design feature. It's an economic parameter of the art form. You want to make a movie for a mass audience, it's got to be accessible.
And you're not necessarily talking about levels of intelligence here, but when you, as a film scholar, watch a film, you can identify certain characteristics of the film, whether narratively or ideologically or stylistically, and say your subconscious says, oh, this is that. So there's less cognition necessary for you when it comes to watching that film. So you've got more available brain space.
That's right. So that's a really good way to put it, I would say. And what, you know, just to follow up on what you're saying. So experts, it's not necessarily the case that experts want to be challenged more than novices. There are many studies that show that experts want more complex movies and more novel movies, and that novices prefer more representational art, they prefer more simple art and more conventional art. And I think the natural assumption from that, from those studies, is, well, experts like to be challenged more, but I don't think that that's the case. I think what's happening is experts are chunking information. They've seen enough that they see things in combinations. And so a complex movie for a novice is not going to be very challenging for an expert. I would say everybody wants to be moderately challenged. It's just that experts require more complexity and novelty to be challenged moderately than do novices.
But is there also a different reason that a novice might go to a film than, say, you, Todd Berliner, professor of film studies at UNCW, would go see a film?
I don't think so. Not for me. I mean, I know I have colleagues that would say that that's true of them. But I think I go to movies for the same reason that everybody does, and which is to get aesthetic pleasure. I think that's our primary motivation. As I said, there are other motivations and there are other reasons that Hollywood movies become popular, having to do with advertising and, you know, pre-sold properties and all sorts of other reasons. But one of the reasons, and I think the main reason people go to movies, is for aesthetic pleasure. Now, it may be that because I'm a film expert, I prefer different types of movies, perhaps more complicated movies, perhaps more novel movies than a novice. But I think we're going for the same experience. We want to be emotionally engaged. We want to be intellectually stimulated. We don't want it to overwhelm us, but we don't want to be bored.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM in Wilmington and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. It's an exploration of the elements of pleasure in Hollywood movies, why we like them, why they fail us. Answering your questions on this Thursday, Todd Berliner. He is a professor of film studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and he was the founding chair of that department. He's also the author of Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. We'd also like to hear about the films that you enjoy. You can reach us at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. John from Wilmington called in and said he'd like to hear your thoughts on Videodrome. It's a sci-fi film starring Deborah Harry, and it's his favorite film.
Yeah, so Videodrome, again, this is another movie. I've seen it, but it's been a long time. I think it's a Cronenberg movie, if I remember right. So it's a cult film. So John is part of that cult. And
John, you're part of a cult.
Yeah, or I should say a cult audience to be less abrasive. So the thing about cult films is that they alienate a mass audience and they exhilarate a smaller one. So one of the theses of the book, perhaps the main and most interesting thesis in the book, is that there's going to be a point for each of us where a movie becomes too complicated or too strange for us to enjoy it. And as soon as we cross that line, we've given up on the movie.
Are you talking about the hedonic scale?
Right. That, yeah. Maybe
not really?
Okay. Maybe we don't have to use that term.
Okay.
We don't want to alienate this audience.
Right, right.
So, but there's going to be a point where our pleasure starts to diminish and will drop off severely because we can no longer cope or we're no longer willing to cope with whatever challenging properties.
Why is Videodrome so challenging?
So the thing about movies like Videodrome is they approach that line, okay? And as we get closer to that line between coping and not coping, as long as we don't cross it, we're going to have a great experience, okay? So the closer we come to that line, and it's going to be different for different people, the more exciting a movie gets, the more exhilarated we become, and the more pleasure, our pleasure becomes intense because it's challenging us. We can't quite master that work. And for a movie like Videodrome, which is very strange, it has a very unpredictable narrative, it's surrealist, it's disgusting,
it's disgusting.
Oh, yeah. It challenges our ability to cope, to understand.
Give us an example of a disgusting scene in the film.
Oh, well, it's been a long time, but I think there's a scene where somebody eats their own internal organs, if I remember right.
That's disgusting.
So it's not going to appeal to a mass audience, it's going to cross that line.
Right.
But for the smaller audience, like John, that is excited by that, that finds it interesting and challenging, it's going to be very exhilarating because it didn't cross the line for John
and
for other people who are in that smaller cult audience.
Susan writes, Night of the Hunter, my whole family enjoys it time after time. Thoughts on Night of the Hunter?
Well, Night of the Hunter is a sort of darling in the film studies community because it's strange, because it's challenging, because it's got a charismatic villain, because children are threatened in it. But it's a very bizarre movie that's had a lasting impact on film studies. In the movie, the main villain has written love and hate on his knuckles, and that's appeared in multiple movies since then as a kind of homage, including Do the Right Thing and others, as a kind of homage to Night of the Hunter. And that, too, is an exciting movie. It's also – it's part of a series of the film noir series. So it's ideologically very confused, and it's very stylish. So interesting use of chiaroscuro lighting. It's a intense light and dark in the movie. I don't mean thematically, maybe that too, but just visually, it's beautifully photographed.
We have an email from James who writes, I remember my introduction to your film noir class, talking about Professor Todd Berliner at UNCW, when you first arrived to the UNCW English department maybe 20 years ago. Every one of the movies we watched wasn't new to me. What became new to me was my appreciation to the aesthetic of the films. I was taught to appreciate the shadows and hidden nuance. That appreciation follows me to this day, especially during the lonely nights overseas in Afghanistan, escaping even for just a moment into a different world than what was going on. I thank you always for teaching me the art of such appreciation. And he says, my favorite movie of all time would have to be Young Frankenstein. I truly feel that no one could find the hidden comedic nuance better than Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder.
Well, first of all, that was James.
Yes.
Yes. First of all, I just want to thank you, James, for saying such kind things, generous comments about that class that I taught. I have taught film noir a few times since then, but I did teach it early in my career when I was in the English department. Young Frankenstein, that's a beloved movie, written by Gene Wilder, directed by Mel Brooks. It's hysterical. It's interesting. It's like almost all Mel Brooks movies, it's a genre parody. And Mel Brooks has had, I think, a longer life than a lot of people imagined he would when he made these movies. And, you know, most of his big movies were made in the 70s. And my students still love Mel Brooks movies.
And I heard this actually from someone yesterday who was talking about this show today and saying, yeah, Mel Brooks. I mean, that's the peak of film comedy for him. What's different about Mel Brooks and the way he approaches comedy in movies that works so well?
Well, one thing, he almost invented a genre, which is the comic parody. Now, of course, there had been many comic parodies before Mel Brooks, dating back to Dr. Prickle and Mr. Pride, which is a Laurel and Hardy movie from the teens. So, of course, we have comic parodies of serious genres, you know, dating back to the silent era. But Mel Brooks specialized in that, and he decided, you know, this is going to be my genre. He loves Hollywood, so he's extremely informed about Hollywood movies. So he was a good candidate to perfect this genre or advance this genre. And he sort of systematically said, okay, we're going to do a parody of Hitchcock. We're going to do a parody of the Western. We're going to do a parody of the Universal Horror Pictures, et cetera, like Young Frankenstein. And he did this with many genres. But he was a comic writer. He wrote for television. He was a director people liked to work with. He got great casts. People like Gene Wilder and Cleavon Little and others loved to work with him. And so I think that, you know, at a certain point, it becomes very difficult to say, you know, why his movies lasted. But he certainly was able to take that comic genre to places that, you know, nobody else has been able to do.
Alan says, I'm interested in your guest's opinion of La La Land, which I turned off after 10 minutes. This film won an Oscar or two or some, I don't know how many.
Probably.
But there was a kerfuffle around that. I think this is one of those Hollywood musicals when in the era of people saying Hollywood musicals don't work on film. And you devote a whole section in your book to this. So we'll hear from you about this idea of musicals on film and how that's evolved over the years when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation with film studies professor Todd Berliner at UNCW. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your own question and your favorite film. The number during this live Thursday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring what makes watching a really great Hollywood movie so pleasurable. What's the line between bringing us pleasure, challenging us a little bit, and becoming so much cognitive effort that we check out? And why do some films stand the test of time? We're exploring those questions with Todd Berliner. He's a professor of film studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and he's the author of Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. What's your favorite film? What film do you think the critics just really got wrong? And what have they missed? Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, we were talking about Alan's question around La La Land, which he says he turned off after 10 minutes. Movie musical. What do you think about that film?
Well, I saw it in the theater, so I couldn't turn it off. But cognitively, I turned it off after about 10 minutes.
Oh.
I thought the movie was kind of dull. I think the thing about La La Land that I've never heard anyone respond to this criticism is that there isn't a single memorable song in it. And a musical without a memorable song? I mean, if I said, okay, you know, tell me a memorable song from Wizard of Oz or whatever, you know, like any of the Singing in the Rain, you would be able to rattle, oh, I love that song, or Over the Rainbow or whatever it is. But in La La Land, who knows any of those songs? So I think that's a problem, right? I think that's an incontrovertible problem, that if you don't have any hits in the movie musical,
right,
it can't be a good musical.
Which is a similar principle if you're talking about Broadway musicals and seeing a live show. You want to walk out of the theater humming the tune. But why did it do so well?
Yeah, you got me. So my book is not about why movies make money. My book is about what gives movie what gives people pleasure in the movies, and, which it may be a different answer. Mm-hmm. They're related, but not necessarily the same answer. And why certain movies stand the test of time.
So do you think in 10 years we'll be talking about La La Land?
I think we will not. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that La La Land is a flash in the pan.
Okay. Now, there may be this. 2027,
there
we call
go.
Todd Berliner.
Yeah, you have me back on the show, and I can either eat crow or I can gloat. But it's possible that La La Land will have other effects. It's possible that since the musical genre is essentially a dead genre now, you get a musical every few years out of Hollywood. It used to be Hollywood would make, you know, dozens or many more than dozens of movie musicals a year in between the 1930s and the 1950s. And then there was nothing. I mean, it just, you know, all of a sudden, you were having all these musicals, American in Paris, Singing in the Rain, Gigi, et cetera, and then nothing,
and
almost nothing.
Why?
Well, people became alienated from the genre. Film styles changed, and there was a new kind of grittiness in Hollywood cinema in the 60s and 70s that was antipathetic to the movie musical.
So getting much more realistic.
That's one way to put it. The other thing is music styles changed. And rock became the popular idiom. And rock didn't lend itself to that kind of intimate, chatty song that was a kind of conversation between two characters. And that type of musical was, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, that's what pop music was. It was George Gershwin, or it was Irving Berlin, it was Cole Porter. That idiom of music lent itself to this kind of dialogue song, whereas rock music, much more instinctive, you know, much more sort of visceral, it didn't have that sophisticated, casual style. And then you lose that, you've also lost one of the primary tools within the musical. And then also the Hollywood studios were in terrible financial trouble in the 60s, and they had to give up their chorines, their orchestras, their songwriters, their musical performers that were the benchmark, that were the sort of necessary tools for making musicals, which were a traditionally very expensive genre. But if you had all these people on staff, you could churn them out. Whereas if you had to get all these people to make a movie, which you had to do after the studio system collapsed in the 60s, that became a very expensive thing to do. So you've got people alienated from the genre, you've got different styles, and you've also got this genre that became very expensive to make, and the combination was just deadly.
And we actually have a clip from Top Hat, one of those movie musicals. I think it's clip number 8. And what are we going to be listening for in this?
Okay, so this is a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musical, fabulous musical from the early 30s, mid-30s. I think it's 34. And in this clip, Astaire is wooing Ginger Rogers. He's trying to, what they used to call make love, but today that has a different meaning. So he's making love to her. He's trying to get her to fall in love with him. And he does it through song. And the thing that I want people to listen for in this is the way in which the movie eases into song. It begins sort of chatty, conversational, and doesn't become full-blown singing until after some transition.
Okay, let's listen.
And there you have your shower. He comforts her. They spark. That's the lightning. They kiss. Thunder. The thunder and lightning seem to be having their way. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a lovely day.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Keep singing, Todd.
Oh, there you go. You don't want that.
But it's so nice the way he's having this conversation with her, and then it just seemingly naturally evolves into a song that I believe was organic.
Yeah, so what songwriters and musical filmmakers did at that time was they would get their they would write the scene, and they would bring in the songwriters, in this case Irving Berlin, to write a song for that scene. And so it was not as integrated as the Broadway musical, but they did make efforts to integrate song into the storyline. And sometimes the songwriters would also write surrounding dialogue. And so in the clip that you just heard, Astaire starts to talk in a kind of poetic style. There's the lightning, the thunder. And the thunder, when he says thunder, you hear a thunderclap, and it also brings in the music.
Yes.
And then he eases into what was called the verse. Now, this is a convention of popular music in the 30s that we don't have today. The verse was an introductory, more prosaic part of the song in which it was a kind of transition into a song. And before you had full-blown melody, you very often had a verse, which was often expendable. On records, they would sometimes throw it out. But in Hollywood musicals, they like to keep it because it was more prosaic and it could be used as a transitional device into full-blown song. We never actually, in the clip you play, we never actually heard the full-blown melody. We were transitioning in the verse before, you know, before the end of the clip.
We're talking with UNCW Film Studies professor Todd Berliner. He's the author of the new book, Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. And we have just a few minutes left in today's discussion. You can call us during the live Thursday show at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Nancy writes, I've been thinking lately about the movie Harold and Maude. Any comments?
That's another movie, another cult movie like Videodrome that's edgy. It's edgy in a different way in Harold and Maude. It's edgy because it's about a romance between a 79-year-old woman and I think a 16-year-old boy.
That sounds creepy.
Yeah, it sounds creepy, and that's what made it a cult movie because it's screwball comedy. Well, screwball is the wrong word, but it's a mismatched couple taken as far as you could go.
Doesn't Woody Allen do that too? I mean, how is that not pedophilia?
Yeah, well, it's. I think when it's the gender here matters. So Maude is played by Ruth Gordon, who, you know, was, I think, pushing 80 at the time. And Harold is played by Bud Cort, who was, I think he was in his 20s, but he's playing a much younger man. And they, I mean, it's, they have sex. They really take it far. And it was a cult movie. It was a 1971 movie. It became a very popular movie because it had a very life-affirming message. It's also a lot of fun. It's very funny. It's funnier than it sounds. If you haven't seen the movie, it probably sounds weird.
Yeah.
But they normalize it and they make it, you know, very dear and very romantic and very interesting and challenging. And it's also scored by fabulous Cat Stevens songs.
We have an email from Candace who writes, my favorite film is No Way Out. The first time you see it, there's a surprise ending. So why do I enjoy watching it over and over, even though I know what the surprise is? Good question.
So that's a really good question. And it's a perennial question because why do we watch movies over and over anyway? Why do we feel suspense the fourth time we watch a Hitchcock movie? So part of our brain is obviously forgetting or reliving it the initial time. No Way Out, I also love No Way Out. I've only seen it once, but I loved it. It's a remake of a 40s or 50s movie called The Big Clock. And the remake's with Kevin Costner. And a lot of these noir from the studio era have been remade in the 80s, 90s, and beyond. But it's a really good question. Why do we, you know, twist films like Psycho and Witness for the Prosecution and Sixth Sense and Planet of the Apes, some of these movies, you know, we want to return to them. We want to relive them and sort of pretend that we don't know how they end. And it doesn't take much to pretend either. It's pretty easy.
We have anonymous writes, David Lynch has always been very divisive as a filmmaker, but strangely made a huge splash on 1990s television with his series Twin Peaks, which gained such a cult audience since its cancellation that it's seen a revival on Showtime. What do you think about filmmakers like David Lynch who make films that are known for being challenging, often inaccessible to mass audiences, i.e. Eraserhead or Mulholland Drive, but make a splash when going for television? Interesting tidbit, my favorite film, Mulholland Drive, starred a failed David Lynch TV pilot.
Yeah. So Mulholland Drive, yeah, he is right. Mulholland Drive started as a TV show, and he ended up cutting it as a movie. And it ended up being a popular movie. And it's strange because David Lynch is a surrealist filmmaker. He is probably the only filmmaker who's working in Hollywood who makes truly indeterminate movies, movies that you cannot say for sure what the plots were. And the reason I think he can get away with it, whereas other people who have tried to do that have not on a mass scale, is that he makes his surfaces interesting. So even though the plot may not add up, or it may add up and you have to kind of imagine how it might, or it's deeply ambiguous what the storyline is, Mulholland Drive is one, but you know, Lost Highway is even more difficult to master. On the scene-by-scene level, David Lynch is interesting. So you may not know how this scene connects to that scene, but this scene is fascinating just on its surface what is happening. And I think that's how he's able to get away with it. So he's not totally allegorical in his filmmaking, which might be alienating for audiences. But what he can do is write a great scene and direct a great scene. And that, I think, fuels the popular interest in David Lynch, both in his movies like Mulholland Drive, as well as in his TV show. He also made a fabulous mainstream movie, The Elephant Man, which I think holds up very well from the 80s.
You hold up Citizen Kane as a great example of narrative disunity. Can you talk about why? And then I also want to hear about this Rosebud issue that you bring up in your book.
Well, Citizen Kane is kind of the North Star. What Shakespeare is to literary studies, Citizen Kane is to film studies. And so it's hard to have any conversation about film where it doesn't eventually come up. And that's because it was an experimental movie for 1941. It still feels strange and experimental. It was testing a lot of – it was challenging a lot of norms, both in terms of its cinematography. Wells collaborated with probably the leading cinematographer of the time, Greg Tolan, and also in its narrative. It's a flashback narrative. It's told through multiple perspectives. It feels very modern that way, Citizen Kane, and did at the time. It wasn't the first to do anything. It was not the first. People say it's the first to show a ceiling. It's the first to have a flashback narrative. It's the first to have subjective camera work, et cetera. None of that's true. But it did take these... It did them all, and it took them to a pretty far level. Also, Wells made sure to hire experts like Greg Tolan who could accomplish these things and make it visually interesting. So Citizen Kane is narratively challenging, it's stylistically challenging, but it's still a Hollywood movie. It's still organized around a character, not Kane, the reporter Thompson, who wants to achieve a goal, in this case to find out what the meaning of Rosebud is, Kane's last words. He has to overcome obstacles, people who don't want to talk to him, people who don't know, etc. And at the end, he either achieves his goal or he doesn't. That's a conventional Hollywood story. That's every Hollywood story. But it's been so Wells and Tolan sort of conformed some pretty unusual cinematography and narrative storytelling into a conventional classical model.
And you point to a kind of pivotal plot point in that film as being problematic.
Yes. Well, I was not the first one to notice that nobody overheard Kane say Rosebud. So people have remarked on the fact that there's no way anyone would know that they were his last words because he was alone when he said them. And when a reporter reportedly told this to Wells, he paused for a moment, looked into the air and said, "Don't you tell anyone of this." Because
and so that what does that mean? It was a mistake?
Maybe. Yeah.
It's and certainly, that's our true north.
There you go.
That's this edition of Coastline. Todd Berliner, what a pleasure having you with us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Rachel.
The new book, Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema, is available now everywhere. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast. You can find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM in Wilmington and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.